Last week, actually several weeks ago, but we began last week going into the Song of Solomon. I did have some good feedback. A couple people emailed and called and mentioned a couple of things. They wanted me to review some of what we had in chapter 1 because last week I brought two different Bibles and I was going back and forth between the two and missed a couple things in verse 4. But secondly, there's some of the new translations, notably the New King James and others, they already have a little block in there saying so-and-so is talking. They've got it blocked out themselves. So this is not the original. It's what the translators of this version put in there. And in some cases, they are correct. In some cases, they are incorrect, according to the way I understand it. So I'll tell you what the verses are, who's speaking as we go through it in each verse. And if you already have a Bible that has little headings saying the beloved or the daughters or the whatever, the Shulamite, you may want to have to cross some of those out and say, well, that's probably not correct, but if they interpret it that way, it's fine. So I'm going to begin in verse 2 of chapter 1 of the Song of Solomon. We'll review chapter 1 fairly quickly, and I think we'll be able to get through at least over to the beginning of the second act of the play. As we mentioned, the Song of Solomon is a play, and that it is done on stage. If we begin the first act, we are in Solomon's royal palace. We are probably in the room where his throne is. There are court ladies there. There are other advisors there. It may be more of outside in a royal place where he's sitting, but he is certainly there. It is in Solomon's presence that she's been brought. And this is the first temptation of the Shulamite woman who is betrothed to the Shunem, the shepherd of Shuman, or Shunem. And, of course, he is preparing a place for them to live where he will then someday come back and take her off to the place he's prepared for her. But they are legally married because they have gone through the betrothal ceremony. So she begins in verse 2 and says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth." This is the Shulamite woman talking. And she's standing in the front of the stage and she's announcing how much she wants to be with the man she's betrothed to. Now, he's not there, so nobody is kissing anybody, but this is about as close as it gets to any physical contact during this book. Those who interpret the book as being a honeymoon manual, as I mentioned last week, I would simply disagree with them. There is no official doctrine about this book, no official written statement of any kind from the United Church of God. So other interpretations of the book, I'm not going to argue with at all. This is the way I understand it, and I believe there are serious flaws and serious conflicts within the book if you try to force it into being a honeymoon manual or allegorical about Christ and the church. So the Shulamite woman, who represents each one of us as an individual that is betrothed to Jesus Christ, because betrothals are done on an individual basis. They are not done by group. She begins by saying, "Let him kiss him with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." In other words, she's anxious to the time when they can then live together. "Because of the fragrance of your good ointment, your name is ointment poured forth." So she's simply saying here that the lady is talking about these ointments that remind her of him, that she can sort of smell his presence, or she can smell, because they have given each other this, I guess, a little spikenard or a little container that would remind her of the fact that she is going to marry him, and in fact she is betrothed to him. Christ has given us the essence of his Holy Spirit, and that reminds us of the fact that he wants us someday to be with him in spirit completely. She says, therefore, verse 4, the first part of verse 4 is the end of her little speech. She says, "Your name is poured forth like ointment. Therefore, the virgins love you. Draw me away. Come get me and take me away." That's the end of her statement. She's saying, come rescue me. Come take me from where I am. I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for the time when we can then be together. Now, I want to hold our place there and go back to Revelation chapter 14 and verse 4. As we go through this book, there are a number of phrases, just the way that it's worded, that are sort of repeated in the New Testament. You will find some of these same phrases or subjects covered, and when you go back and read them in the New Testament, you find out that there is a spiritual link. There is a connection between the two. And it does tell us something about the way the book Song of Solomon is inspired, and that we can read it every day to show us how we ought to be dedicated to the one that we are betrothed to. And just like Abraham, we seek a city that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God, and we are waiting for Jesus Christ to return with the place he has prepared for us. In Revelation chapter 14 and verse 4, it says here, "These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. They are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. Now, the phrase, all the virgins love you, you know, may be connected to this verse, that all those who are virgins, spiritually speaking, love the one who is preparing a place for us. It's also true that maybe what she is saying is all the virgins in the land would like to be betrothed to my betrothed because he has all these good qualities, that he's a very desirous person to be married to. So it says, these are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. For in their mouth was found no deceit. They are without fault before the throne of God. Now, she's standing before the throne of Solomon, very likely, in this opening act. So there may be, you know, sort of a connection there too, but there are these virgins, these daughters of Jerusalem that are there in this room with her. And so she's saying all the virgins would love the one I'm betrothed to. And then she talks to him, says, draw me away. Now, of course, the beloved is not there in person. He doesn't appear in this book. He's actually behind a wall or behind the lattice, behind the fence, as we see later. But we do hear his voice fairly often. So the Shulamite lady says then, in the last part of verse 4, the king has brought me into his chambers. So the king has brought her in there because he wants to tempt her. He wants to get her away from her betrothal with her beloved and wants to make her his wife. So she says, the king has brought me into his chambers. Then the last part of this verse is probably the daughters of Jerusalem, so they probably have this correct in the way the New King James Version has it drawn out. They said, we'll be glad and rejoice in you. So the king has brought me into the chambers is singular, then the next line is plural. We'll be glad and rejoice. In other words, if you marry Solomon, we're all going to celebrate with you. We're all going to think this is great. We're all going to think this is wonderful. We will remember your love more than wine. So the daughters of Jerusalem are, you know, saying this, and they probably also say the line, rightly do they love you. In other words, rightly do all the men or all those who are in, you know, in this lady's life, rightly do they love her. So I would disagree with the New King James and actually say that the next line, rightly do they love you, was probably spoken by these daughters of Jerusalem. Now, the betrothed lady, the Shulamite, is not just saying she is being upright and going to be leveled, be loyal to her beloved and betrothed. Although she is saying that, she's also saying that she is going to resist the influences of these other ladies here who want her to be a part of Solomon's court. Now, we live in a world where Satan is the god of this world. It has glitter, it has gold, it has all these physical things. As we mentioned here then last week, verse 5, the Shulamite woman begins to speak, and she says, I am suntanned but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. She is answering them back. So they have spoken to her, and she says, yes, I am tanned. I've been working in the field, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. But don't look at me because I am tanned or hard-worn. I have calluses on my hands because the sun has tanned me. She says, I've been out working in the fields. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards. So she's saying that her brothers made her work in the vineyard. They were angry with her, very likely because she did not just cave in and marry Solomon. They could have gotten money, lands, territory. Who knows what they would have gotten had she married him. They would have been the brothers of the queen, which would have definitely raised their status. Then down in verse 7, she says she's just talking to her beloved who is way behind the wall or the fence. She's probably out in front stage now and talking off into the audience. This is kind of like, what was that song years ago that was sung by that little mouse, Fifo or Lifo, somewhere out there? And I didn't see the movie. I'm not sure what movie it was. America Does Something? American Tale. So apparently the mouse is out there singing to the stars. Well, somewhere out there, I know my love is out there, and we're worshiping on the same white star, la-ti-da-ti-da-ti-da. So this is kind of like the Somewhere Out There song in the Song of Solomon. I knew that Tony would understand this if I would bring that song up. I'm just kidding. Tell me, oh, you whom I love, where you feed your flock and where you make it rest at noon. So she's saying, tell me where you are. I know you're out there somewhere. Tell me where you're feeding your flock today, where you're making those sheep lie down. For why should I be as one who veils herself? In other words, why should I still have this veil on as being a betrothed woman? Now, according to the traditions, after a woman was officially betrothed, she would wear this veil and whenever she was out in public until the time that she actually lived and moved from her parents' house to the house of her husband and became part of his household. Then she was a married woman, and she was no longer available. But the time she wore the veil was to tell people she was already betrothed, already taken, and that no other men could then begin to court her or desire her in marriage. So she's saying, why should I keep wearing this veil when I really want to be living with you? I really want to be your husband. So they're not living together yet. He's preparing a place for her, but she's saying she wants to go out there and be with him. But there's an interesting parallel, too, that this man is a shepherd, that he's feeding his flock. He makes them to rest at noon. Remember Psalm 23 says, but the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. So there's even a parallel in this verse with Psalm 23 and how Jesus Christ, our shepherd, feeds us and makes us to lie down in green pastures. So she's saying, where is my love? He's out there in the fields with his sheep, making them lie down in green pastures. So she says, why should I shield myself or veil myself by the flocks of your companions, when what she really wanted was, of course, to be married to him? Now then in verse 8, the beloved calls back to her. No, this is the ladies. The New King James is wrong there. The ladies are answering her back. The ladies are trying to convince her now to follow into Solomon's temptations. The ladies here are all dressed up in a variety of clothes, very likely. We don't know how many there were, maybe 5, 10, 15. They are telling her that if you don't know where he is, well, stay here and marry Solomon. Stay here and become the queen. What they are saying in so many words is, you know, my Lord delays his coming. If you have to wait, you know, why not just give it up and do something else? Same type of thing taunts us from time to time when we have these delays. We think we have delays. Obviously, God's schedule or calendar has never really changed. He's always been on time. But our perceptions have changed. And so these ladies say to her, if you don't know, O fairest among women, follow the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats besides the shepherd's tents. So they're saying, well, you know, if you don't know where your shepherd is, just do your own thing. Feed your own little goats beside the shepherd's tents. In other words, live your own life. What they're really saying is succumb or give in to what Solomon wants you to do. Go ahead and become his wife. Now, verse 9 is when Solomon first speaks. He's been sitting on the throne listening to all of these things that have been said, the talk of the young lady, the Shulamite, and, of course, these daughters of Jerusalem. So Solomon would be the third person to speak here. And he says, I have compared you, my love, to my filly, or my little horse, among Pharaoh's chariots. And we talked last time about how Pharaoh's chariots were all decked in red and silver and gold, and normally were white horses. It's interesting that he compares it that way. He says, I've compared you to these beautifully decked horses. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments. You'll look very nice with all these ornaments and gold and nice jewels that will be all over your cheeks and your neck with chains of gold. So he's offering really to bribe her to make her decorated with all of these jewels. She'll no longer have calloused hands, no longer have to work in the fields and have suntanned skin. He's offering her money, but he's also offering to solve what looks to be her current need. Just like Satan the devil oftentimes finds out what we need, what we want, and somehow makes a temptation come our way that he thinks might cause us to stumble. Now, you may have all seen the movie with Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor in it. She kind of has this headband with the thing on her forehead. That may be kind of beyond when some of these kids here were born, but you know, years and years and years ago, there was a Cleopatra movie with Elizabeth Taylor in it, and she wore some of these, I think, jewels or pearls that are described here, something that would be similar to it anyway. Of course, the allure of money and the allure of all these jewels, at least Solomon's first temptation, is very similar to the first one that we read last week in Luke 4 concerning Christ's temptation. So here we have Solomon's offer to her, her first time. Verse 11, we will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. Could very well be Solomon still talking to her. Some of them believe it's the daughters of Jerusalem, you know, trying to encourage her. I believe it's probably Solomon. He's saying, look, if you'll come with me, we'll make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. We'll make you all decorated out with all these beautiful jewelry items. And, of course, historically, women like jewelry, and maybe she did or did not have a desire for that. Verse 12, she answers. So the Shulamite lady answers in verse 12, and she says, the king is at his table while he's there offering me all of these things. I am thinking about my beloved, my spikenard, or my little jar of ointment of sweet-smelling incense that reminds me of my beloved, keeps me from falling. Jesus Christ, or later, talks about our prayers as being like incense, and that perhaps it's referring to the fact that our prayers to God each day or our Bible study each day reminds us that we have a betrothal to a God that is much greater than anything this world can offer. And so she reminds herself of that with this spikenard that she carries. And of course, we need to be carrying our, reminding ourselves also of our covenant with God, and to be at one point then being the bride of Christ. So she says this little spikenard that she carries may have been very small, but it reminds him, or reminded her, of him to whom she was betrothed. It might be also be a parallel, especially the reference to myrrh, verse 13, of God's Spirit. We have a little essence of God's Spirit now. We hope someday to be completely turned into a spirit being and serving, of course, in the house of God. And she says, my beloved is to me as a cluster of henna blooms or a cluster of myrrh, a cluster of beautiful flowers, and in the vineyards of En Gedi, so even out in the desert. Now, verse 15, the beloved or the beloved one, the one to whom she is betrothed, he speaks to her off in the distance. And we probably would hear this on stage, and we'd just hear the voice coming from somewhere in the back. She's in the building with Solomon. In the distance, she hears this shepherd reminding her that he's very pleased with her, that she has followed him, and she has been loyal. So he says, behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes. In other words, you are loyal to me, and you are very fair. You are very pleasing. Now let's go over to 1 John chapter 3 and verse 22. Sometimes I think we forget the concept that when we please God, when we obey God, it pleases him. That when we do those things that are pleasing in his sight, such as refusing temptation, that it is a good thing, and that it makes him feel better. Just like the betrothed here, the one that she is her beloved, when he understands that she has been tempted by another man, and she says, no, I'm reminded of my beloved, I'm reminded by the spikenard of ointment that I carry around, by this sweet smell, I'm reminded of our relationship being like myrrh, and I'm anxious to be with him, then the beloved is very happy. He's pleased that her loyalty to him has been illustrated. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 22 says, whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep, his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. So that's the key. If we are betrothed to Jesus Christ, then we should be doing those things that are pleasing in his sight. And there are many of them. You think about the Sermon on the Mount. You know, blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who are peacemakers. You know, blessed are those who mourn. They shall be comforted. And of course, loving one another, verse 23, this is his commandment, that we should believe on the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another as he gave us commandment. And he who keeps his commandments abides in him, and he in him. And by this we know that he abides in us by the Spirit which he has given to us. So the fact in verse 15 then of chapter 1 that the beloved calls back to her and says, you know, complimentary things, you are fair, you are wonderful, you have dove's eyes, he's showing he approves of what she has done and how she has handled the temptation so far. Now she responds back to him in verse 16. We have the Shulamite lady answering him saying, you are fair. In other words, she goes back to him and says, yes, you are handsome, my beloved. So while she's being tempted by Solomon, she is thinking about how handsome her future husband is. And then she reminds herself that he is preparing a house for them to live in. She says, also, our bed is green, or our place where you are going to live is growing, it is developing. The beams of our houses are cedar, and our rafters of fir. Now, these verses tell us that she has a lot of confidence in the house that he is building for her, because he is the shepherd up around, of course, it's north of there, up in Shuman, near Mount Hermon, the area today called Lebanon. And she is anxious for him to come back and marry her and take her back with him to the house where they can then share that place as their family. Now chapter 2 continues. It actually doesn't shouldn't necessarily be a break there. She just simply says, I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Now, the rose of Sharon was a plant, a rose, that grew. It's actually a bush. It grows into actually a fairly large bush. And they grew up in the valleys that came down from Mount Hermon, or Mount Hermon. And they were often, you know, chosen as flowers, very special flowers. The flowers get fairly large. They're red or pink in color. So she is saying, I am the flower that he chose out of all the ones in the desert. So I'm the rose of Sharon. I am the one that he chose. And she's very appreciative that she was chosen out of all these flowers in the desert. We also are chosen. We are thankful that of all the billions of people on the earth, and there are very, very few that understand God's truth, you know, how thankful we should be that God has given us the pearl of great price. So we could all say we are like a flower that has been specially picked or chosen by God because he has given us the knowledge of his truth, and very, very few people have ever had that. So when she says, I'm the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys, she's simply saying, I was very desired. I was a very desired flower. I was specially picked by him. So she's essentially giving him the compliment because she was chosen by him and he passed the others up. So she understood that her calling to be his wife was a very special thing indeed. Now let's continue then in verse 2. Like a lily among the thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Now this is the beloved speaking. He's saying back to her, they're sort of carrying on a conversation now through this wall. They're still, by the way, in the court. There's still Solomon there. There's still these other ladies there, the ladies of Jerusalem, the daughters of Jerusalem. And maybe, in fact, her brothers, two or three of them are there. We don't know who all was on stage. But he calls back to her and says, like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Now, when he said thorns, is he trying to insult these other girls of Jerusalem who were trying to tempt her to go back, you know, on her word? We really don't know. If he's saying she's a lily among thorns, he's saying she is the most attractive and most desirable out of all these others, and that he's anxious for the time when he'll come back then and take her to be living with him as his wife. So she said, he says, she's very special. I chose her like a lily among thorns. So is my love among the daughters. She is the most special among all those daughters. Then she talks back to him, and she says, like an apple tree among the trees of the woods. So in other words, there's a lot of trees in the woods, but he is an apple tree that produces fruit. Essentially what she is saying is that others don't produce fruit, but my beloved, the one to whom I betrothed, does produce fruit. Like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. So he compliments her and says, well, you're like a lily among thorns among all those daughters. And then she compliments him and says, like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, you are the tree that is the one that produces fruit. So is my beloved. Now, I want to say right there and go over to Hebrews chapter 6 in verse 4. The concept that Jesus Christ is a fruitful individual or produces fruit is also again in the New Testament. We are in Jesus Christ's shadow. We are kept close to him. We can't see him, of course. But the Bible says we have tasted already of the fruit of his spirit, or the fruit of his tree, the heavenly gift. In Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 4, it is impossible for those who were once enlightened and have tasted the heavenly gift. So she speaks of her future husband, her betrothed, as producing fruit. Here we are spoken of as having tasted the heavenly gift. So that have become partakers of the Holy Spirit and have tasted the good word of God and the powers of the age to come. So the one that we are betrothed to produces good fruit, lets us taste the good word of God and a little essence of the powers to come. Nothing like what it will be. But when she says her beloved is like a fruitful tree among a bunch of others that are not fruitful, then I think there are some interesting parallels. Maybe a spiritual lesson there that tells us more about what this book is about. Now, if we go back to the last part of verse 3, this is one of several sections in this entire book where we are not 100% sure if this took place when they were together and were betrothed or if she's simply seeing it in vision. Now, what I mean by that, she says, I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. So does that mean that at an earlier time when they knew each other, And they were betrothed, which of course they would have had to have been. They would have known each other and been betrothed to each other. Did she sit down in his shade and have an apple, or when they made their public commitment, when they made their promise to say, we are going to be married at a certain time in the future, and we're officially betrothed, did she then taste of the fruit of his garden or of his trees at that time? Or is she simply saying in the future, she's kind of seeing herself, I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste? Well, we really don't know. Most people in the Bible obviously were together when they were betrothed. Rebekah was not. When Rebekah was officially married to Isaac, she was still over in the land where her father was. And, of course, Abraham's servant had to bring her back. And so then she went to Isaac, and they were basically already married before she even came back. So that's the way God calls people. Jesus Christ doesn't come down and physically appear to us. When we make our betrothal commitment to him, we are familiar with his teachings, with his words, and what he wants us to do. And so we make that betrothal like Rebekah did before she even knew Isaac. She knew of him, but had not yet met him, the same way we do. So I'm not quite sure how the last part of verse 3 should be interpreted, but certainly she is saying that she's anxious to sit down and partake of his fruit, and that his fruit was sweet to my taste, or is sweet. The word was is in italics, it's not in the original, so his fruit is sweet or will be sweet to my taste. It would also be a correct way to translate that. In verse 4, he brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner was over me was love. Now, that hasn't happened yet. The banqueting house would be the time of the wedding supper, when they would come back to his house and have this great big banquet. Just like when Jesus Christ returns, we will have a wedding supper of some kind, a banquet. Notice his banner over me, and that would be a banner that would essentially say you're now a part of this family. In the New Testament, we have several indications that God will give us a new name, that we will have a name that will last forever. Revelation mentions that several places in Revelation 2 and 3. So the banner giving her a new name and the banquet where they will be having their marriage finally consummated has not yet happened. So what she is saying here is she's picturing it happening in her mind, but it hasn't yet happened then. She's looking forward to the time when she eats of his fruit, goes to the banqueting house, and has this banner, has this new name then, new nature pronounced on her. So then in verse 5, we have the temporary life. Sustain me with cakes of raisins. Now in this case, what she's saying is that until we have this banquet, I'm going to have to eat these things that are normally called travel food. The raisins were, cakes they put together with dried figs, dried grapes, and various other things that would last a while. They would put them together like modern-day granola bars or Fig Newtons or something, and they could carry them in a bag as they traveled. Now, they didn't have restaurants along the way. They didn't have McDonald's. They didn't have Kentucky Fried Chicken on every corner. They didn't have Starbucks. So they had to live on temporary food as they traveled. And so she said, sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. She says, until I can go to the banquet, until I can be under that banner and partake of the fruit of my husband, I'm going to have to live on a sustenance diet of these temporary foods of cakes of raisins or the fruit I can take along with me. So she is looking forward to that time very much. She says, I am lovesick. Now, it doesn't mean she's sick of love and anxious to not, be a part of it. In other words, she was very desirous for her husband. She's very desirous for the relationship that they would have when they were finally married together. Now, that's a concept I think we have lost a little bit over the years in God's church. We have lost some of the concept of being heartsick for God's kingdom and really being anxious for the imminent return of Jesus Christ. Oh, in the early years, we had predictions that Christ was going to come in 1975 and 1987 and other times. And perhaps because those days didn't work out, we have grown a little bit weary or fearsome, you might say, of even thinking about dates. We're not to think about dates, but we are to have a real strong desire, a fervent desire that Jesus Christ will return. It is not the mindset that God wants us to have to say, well, it doesn't matter when he returns, I'll just live my life, on a daily basis. She's expressing here that she really is almost sick because she wants to be married so badly. And we need to be a little more along that line. We want Jesus Christ's kingdom to come so that all the suffering can stop, all the pain, all the sorrow can stop. And we need to make sure that we really are focused on his kingdom returning to the earth and not just saying, well, this temporary existence is fine. She's saying, I really want to be in that banquet. I really want to have the new house and that new name over me, and I want to be a part of my husband's family and household. And she said, in the meantime, I'm eating temporary food, but I'm really lovesick and anxious to have that brought to me and have that time come now. So we need to think more about this temporary life that we live, and that this banqueting that we want to go to, the, you know, this wedding supper that's mentioned several times in the scriptures, one of those things we have very little knowledge about. I wish we had more detail. I'd like to see, you know, two or three chapters about the wedding supper. All we have is a couple of verses and then a couple of parables, and we don't have much detail. But we ought to be thinking about it and desirous of that time even more than we are, more than we have been, certainly. Now, verse 6 is perhaps one of the most mistranslated and miscommented about verses in the entire Bible. Certainly, if you've read some of those books like Solomon on Sex or others, when they come to this verse, it's actually perverted what they say, this word, this verse means. It's frankly disgusting. The first time I read that comment, I think it was in that book or one like it, you just get mad, just got really upset, saying, you know, that they are so wrong. They have taken some of these assumptions people have made in the Middle Ages or a little bit later, and I think the person who probably came to some of those conclusions may have had some fantasy problems or sexual control problems. I'm not sure what they would be. But if you look up verse 6 in some of the commentaries or some of the books written on the Song of Solomon, my guess is you're going to find something that I would say is simply completely wrong and completely misdirected. But I'll tell you what it does mean. She says, his left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. Now, it doesn't mean he's there because he's back off stage. He is not on stage with her. She's simply saying that the knowledge of him and our relationship that we have being betrothed is what sustains me. Just like the Psalms often mention that God's strong right hand protected Israel coming out of Egypt, and that his strong right hand protects us today. His right hand, the right hand is what you use to work. Remember that the mark of the beast is on a person's right hand. It's what you kind of do things with every day. So she's saying his right hand, the work that he's doing, embraces or supports me. I know that he is building a place for us to live together, preparing a place for us. And his left hand is under my head. The knowledge of him and what he's doing is keeping me to hold my head high and look forward to the future. So she's saying she's making it through this lovesick time because she knows that he is there working for her. It's allegorical. Christ talks about taking us out in eagle's wings or protecting his church in eagle's wings. It wasn't really an eagle, but that was an allegorical representation of it. It's an allegorical way of saying that we are sustained by his strength, and that, of course, is what she is saying. So in our life, you know, his left hand does uphold our head. I mean, we are upheld by the knowledge that we are given. His right hand takes care of us. I think if we knew how many times the angels have protected us and God has sustained us, we would be greatly surprised. It's only the strength of Jesus Christ and the Spirit that he gives us that helps us to, you know, endure each day and also look forward to the time of his kingdom. So verse 6 is really allegorical. She's talking about how she is sustained by her betrothed, and she's anxious to be with him, and that he is there. He is, you know, spiritually helping her a great deal. It is not what many of the commentators will say is a physical act between two people. So I just wanted to mention that part. Verse 7, now she's talking back to the daughters of Jerusalem. She says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases, or until is the right time. Now what she's saying is this, you daughters of Jerusalem, look at the gazelles and the deer out in the field. You cannot force them to have their young until the springtime. It happens in a natural cycle. The animals have a cycle of life. They are born, they grow up, they have a certain time when they breed, a certain time when they have young every year, and a certain time when they prepare for the winter. So she's saying, my life also has a certain time, and I am waiting for the time when a love is supposed to awaken. I'm waiting for the time when it is right to be living then with the man I am betrothed to. Now, the commentators here are very pretty much wrong. They simply get that wrong because they think that the ladies are trying to convince her to go with Solomon. And maybe there's some truth in that, in the sense that she says, I want to be with my beloved, And they say, well, you know, look, he's gone, he's not here, maybe you should go back to work in the field and rethink this. And they want her to go with Solomon. But she says, don't try to stir up or awaken love until it is the right time. In other words, I have a plan and things will work out according to that plan. My betrothed husband will come back with a procession and pick me up with his friends and family from the vineyards he's been working on and take me to the place that he's been preparing for us. Then in verse 8, it says, the voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. So she's simply saying there that she can sort of hear him. She can hear his voice. And he's leaping upon the mountains. He's skipping upon the hills. He is working somewhere else. He is not there, but he is coming. And she's telling him all about him. She's really telling these daughters of Jerusalem about why she prefers him above King Solomon. She says, the voice of my beloved. Now, there are a few commentaries that believe that my beloved is the voice of Solomon. It is not. Behold, he comes. Solomon was already there. So she's saying, my beloved is coming. He is now upon the mountains. He's skipping upon the hills. She said, my beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. So he's strong. He's healthy. He's energetic. He's working up in the hills. He is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he stands behind our wall. He is looking through the windows, gazing through the lattice. Now that's an interesting statement because essentially, first she says he's a big, strong guy. He runs like a deer. He jumps all around. But then she says, he knows what I'm doing. He's able to see. He stands behind the wall. He looks through the windows in the lattice. He understands what I am doing. I cannot betray him because he would find out. So it's interesting because Jesus Christ can see everything. There's nothing hidden from him. Of course, we're living in the time of the Christmas season, and we know that everything about Christmas is a lie. There is no, you know, Christ was not born on December 25th. There is no little boy drummer. Three wise men came probably at least 6 months after Christ was born. But the one thing that makes me the maddest about Christmas is when they talk about Santa Claus, and he's making a list, checking it twice, and then he knows if you've been naughty, knows if you've been nice. He can. It's like he is God who can see everything that children or people do. I mean, they've really transferred the power of God into this fictitious pagan being called Santa Claus. So he sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. I've been years since I've heard the song, but you know, you can't find the radio station this time of the year that's not obnoxious. You get tired of the old talk shows, and you know, the public radio gets old fast with their lefticism. But then the music's bad too. You know, it's all this Christmas stuff. So it's a good time of the year to have some sermons recorded you can play on your radio or your iPod, whatever, in the car. But the concept here is she is saying, my beloved sees, he knows what I'm doing, and he is behind the wall, but he is able to understand and see what goes on through the windows and the lattice. So she is very well aware of the concept that he is there and knows what she is doing, just like we, of course, are there and know what, or he is there and knows what we are doing. Now then she also says in verse 10, my beloved spoke and said to me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. So she's talking about his voice and the things that he is saying. She says, he told me to rise up and come away. For the winter is past and rain is gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth her green figs. The vines with the tender grapes give a good smell. Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. So she is saying in the future, he will say, come to me, that our crops are growing, our grapes are doing well, our figs are putting forth. It is now springtime. So she's telling them, my beloved will come to get me when the place he has prepared for me is finally ready. Now I want to stop there and go over back to John chapter 10. Now she understood that she could hear his voice and understand what he was doing, even though they were separated. She very much keyed on the words that she was able to hear from him, and maybe the things they had said during their time when they were betrothed. But Jesus Christ is the chief shepherd, and he has a voice that we must recognize. Just like the Shulamite woman, we understand his voice as we hear it from a distance, of course, through his written word. John chapter 10 and verse 1. Christ says, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice." So the sheep hear the voice, the doorkeeper comes in, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he brings out his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, and they know his voice. You know, one of the more interesting experiences I had over in Jerusalem in 1974, I'm going to try to go back to the same place. I assume maybe it's all changed a great deal when we go back the next time. But the Mr. Frankel had us all go down. All these Arab sheep herders would bring in their sheep, and in front of, I think it was in front of the, it wasn't the Damascus Gate. It was the one that came around. I forget what the name of the gate was now. It's been so long. But there was a large pen there, and all these sheep were put in one big area. And nobody identified whose sheep belonged to what. And there were five or six, seven shepherds there. And then they would open the gate, and each one of these shepherds would begin giving his call. And suddenly, kind of, la, 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 they would just give their call. And all of these sheep kind of bumped into each other and banged each other. And eventually, all the sheep went right to the shepherd that they belonged to. They all knew the voice of their shepherd. And they put them all in one big pen. And when the shepherd started calling, then they all knew to go to the one that they belonged to. So, of course, that was back in the days before video cameras. So this time I hope when I go I'm able to take a video camera and perhaps see that again, because it's in my memory, but not, I can't, you know, play it in church. But it's a great illustration of what Jesus Christ said here, that his sheep here know his voice, and he calls out his own sheep by name and leads them out. And, of course, that's what Jesus Christ is doing with us. But since it says here very plainly that he who enters the door is the shepherd of the sheep, and the doorkeeper opens and the sheep hear his voice. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 3. Because there's also mentioned in Revelation that the door will open to those who hear his voice and understand it. That's why the Shulamite woman says she heard the voice of her betrothed and she obeyed what he said. She did whatever it would take to please him. So verse 20 of Revelation chapter 3. "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him, and he with me." So notice, he's standing at the door and knocking, but you hear his voice. You hear him saying, "You are welcome to come in." So if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, then I will come into him and dine with him, and he with me. But the person who does that has to respond to the voice of Jesus Christ, who is our Savior, who calls. Some people don't respond to the voice. I think we are all here today because we have responded to his voice. Verse 21, "To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne." And so we are now at the time when we are overcoming. We are being sustained by our cakes of raisins and our temporary food, so to speak, so we can someday then be ruling with Jesus Christ in his throne. So Jesus Christ stands at the door and knock, and of course we must understand his words and follow him. Now let's drop down here a little bit farther to verse 13. We read verse 13. "The fig tree puts forth her green figs, the vines with tender grapes, they give a good smell. Rise up, my love, fair one, and come away." So she's anxious for the time when her beloved would come get her, and they would then go away to the place that he's prepared. Then she says, "O my dove," it's verse 14, "you that are in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the stairs." In verse 14, she quits talking to the ladies and again begins talking to her betrothed, who is off in the distance. So sometimes in her speeches, she'll talk to the ladies of Jerusalem who are standing there probably on her left or her right. And then she turns instead, and the rest of her speech is given over to the wall or to the audience, which basically she's talking to her betrothed. She says, "O my dove, in the clefts of the rock." In other words, you are out there, you are in the clefts of the rock, you are not here. You are in the secret places. She says, "Let me see your face. I want to see your appearance." Actually, the word is also translated as appearance. "I want you to appear to me. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely." So there were, she's saying that he's in a secret place, or a place where I can't see him. She says, "I want to see you. I'm anxious to hear your voice and see you face to face." Now, that's the way we feel about our Savior. We are anxious for Jesus Christ to come. Look at 1 John says, someday we will see Him as He is because we'll be like Him. I mean, none of us can comprehend that. None of us can comprehend what it means to be a spirit being, what it means to be like Jesus Christ is now. But we want to. We're anxious for it. We're like, we have the same feeling she has where she says, I'm anxious to see your face. I'm anxious for you to be here. I'm anxious to hear your voice talking to me one-on-one. So she was very anxious for that. Now, verse 15 is probably her brothers talking. Brother's basically saying, time to go back to the vineyard because, you know, Act 1 is about over. We're just about finished now with Act 1 on the stage here in the book. And very likely, verse 15 is spoken by her brothers. I think the New King James probably has this correct. You know, they're kind of saying, okay, little sister, you've had enough time talking now. It's time to go catch the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. Now, during the time when grapes ripen, of course, they give off a very nice smell. You may have driven past Concord grapes or some other grapes if you live near vineyards. And as they begin to ripen and are ready to pick, they give off a very nice smell. Sometimes you can smell them, you know, quite a distance away. So animals can also smell them, and they come in and eat the grapes. So they had to have somebody who would be round the clock guarding the vineyards. They had watchmen that would watch the vineyards and guard them. And so the brothers are saying, okay, it's time to go stop the foxes or those who would be eating the grapes. Let's go back to the vineyard because you're now, you know, you've turned Solomon down, so let's go back and work in the vineyard. So then she says in verse 15, she's simply saying out loud, the beloved is mine and I am his. He feeds his flock among the lilies. So this is the end of the first temptation. And her position is the same as it was to begin with. My beloved is mine. I am loyal to him. I am his. He is feeding his flock among the lilies. He's feeding out there where all the lilies are, up in the valley where the Rose of Sharon grows. And I am waiting for the time when he will come back to get me. And then she says to her beloved, she's sort of talking over the wall again, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, until, you know, whatever day comes, until the time for us to be together is here, turn my beloved and be like a gazelle or a young stag. In other words, be a very healthy, you know, hardworking animal out there in the desert. You know, be as healthy as the stags and the gazelles. Upon the mountains of Bether. Now, Bether means separation. So she says, you are out there separated from me. But until the day when we can be together, be strong, be productive, be preparing our place to live in as you are out there upon the mountains of separation. So that's the end of the first act. At this point, the curtain would close. At this point, you would have probably a change in scenery. Because as we then begin verse or chapter 3, this is Act 2. And this is the second temptation of Solomon to her. Now it begins not in Solomon's courtyard. He is not here when this begins. The ladies are either out in, like in a courtyard somewhere. One commentator believes they might be out in like a big pasture somewhere. My guess is they are outside Solomon's palace in some sort of a green area with bushes and trees and maybe a park and, you know, maybe a waterfall. Who knows what it might be. But they are certainly out somewhere else. And, of course, she is thinking and she is telling the ladies about a dream she had. She begins speaking, the Shulamite lady does, and she is addressing the daughters of Jerusalem. These daughters of Jerusalem are with her now out in this park or in this area that is outside the palace. She begins on stage, and she begins telling them about a dream that she has. In fact, she's actually begin telling them about, there are two different dreams that she records here in this book. And so as the curtain opens, we are in a different stage, a different setting, and the Shulamite lady says, by night on my bed, I sought the one I love. So I was laying on my bed. I was thinking about the one I love. I was seeking him. I did not find him. She says, I will rise now. I said, I will go to the city in the streets and in the squares and seek the one I love. I sought him but did not find him. Well, hold your place there and go back to Psalm 119 and verse 55. Psalm 119 and verse 55, just a couple books back. In this case, the psalmist wrote that he sought God at night remembered God's name at night. And of course, this lady was having a dream because she was thinking about her beloved and how she wanted to be with him as she was going to sleep in the evening. In Psalm 119 and verse 55, it says, "I remember your name in the night, O Lord, and keep your law. This has become mine because I keep your precepts." So if you think about, let's go back to the Song of Solomon, but there's a principle there that people can and should, according to that example, think about God at night. Now what happens today, of course, is that things are different. Back then, people didn't go to bed after watching Jay Leno make fun of our president for 20 or 30 minutes. They didn't go to bed after watching the evening news and having all the murders and all the robberies and the bad things that happen around the world in their mind. Did you ever find that sometimes you'll wake up, or you'll be at night, and you'll wake up from a dream, and the dream is kind of like what was on your mind before you went to bed? So if you saw a movie, like Ben-Hur, then you go to sleep, and the next thing you know, you're dreaming about driving a chariot. You ever had that kind of experience? Ben-Hur might be an old movie, but that's one of the most recent ones I've seen. Well, not quite. But the point is that she went to sleep at night thinking about her beloved and how much she wanted to be with him. And maybe we ought to look at our lives and try to think about God before we go to bed at night. Maybe set aside 15 minutes to read the Bible instead of another 15 minutes to watch something silly on television or to watch something else that puts us to sleep. So just the thought that she sought her love by night and she was dreaming and she woke up and she was dreaming about trying to find him. Now, he didn't live in the streets. He was out in the mountains. We know that. He was up north. So she was telling these girls about her dream. She says, "I was walking all around the city trying to find the one I love, but I didn't find him. Now, the watchmen who go about the city found me." So she's saying that there were night watchmen in the city in her dream, and they found me. "And I said to them, 'Have you seen the one I love?' Scarcely had I passed by them when I found the one I love. I held him and would not let him go." Now, did not literally happen. She is talking about a dream. First place, he wasn't even in the city. But secondly, she's saying, "In my dream, I found him. I held him, would not let him go, until I brought him into the house of my mother, into the chamber of her who conceived me." Now, that's an interesting verse, because when he comes back to marry her, he will come back to the place where she lives, normally the house where her mother and father live, and then the procession will go to her new home, which would be, of course, where her betrothed husband has prepared a place for her. Now, there's an interesting question here is, how come it says the house of my mother, not the house of my father? How come she didn't say, "Well, he brought me back to the house of my father, and then my father and mother and all of us, all went to the procession to his house"? Now, I've got a thought on that, and this is just my thought. And that is, since she symbolizes each one of us, we are today living with our spiritual mother, the church. The church is called the mother of us all. Our spiritual father is in heaven. He can't come to the house of our father who's in third heaven and bring us, back to the kingdom of God here upon the earth. When Christ returns, he will come to where we are. He will come to where our mother has kept us, where we have had the embryo or the church that Jesus Christ built and said would not die out. And from that location, so to speak, we would then proceed to the Mount of Olives and then have the kingdom of God established and us be a part of it. So that's just a good possibility. I don't know why it says that in this dream she says, "Well, I was brought to the house of my mother." And she's picturing all of this in her mind. She's simply saying, "I pictured being able to have my husband come get me and take me to the place." We picture it by keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. We picture what's going to happen to us by keeping God's holy days every year, but especially the feast where we think, what's it going to be like when Christ rules the earth? What's it going to be like when he is here with us? And so we pictured it in a dream, like she pictured it in a dream here and mentioned to him. And then in verse 5, she says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem." She addresses these ladies who are assembled here, maybe by the gazelles of the field or something close, or at least they can see them. And again she says, "Do not stir up or awaken love until it is the right time." Now, three times in this book, this phrase is used. Three times she reminds herself by telling them, do not try to force this betrothal or this marriage, before it is the right time. Now, there's a waiting period. She knew that. She didn't say, "My Lord delays his coming," because she was anxious to be there with him. But we ought to be also reminding ourselves that God has his calendar, that God has his timetable, and that we can't force Christ to return, but we need to be very anxious for him to return. But she said, don't worry, there is a time coming. He will come and get me when it is the right time. So don't try to force it before it's time, the right time, before it pleases. Now, verse 6, here comes King Solomon. He's coming here with a prepared speech. He's coming time to allure her. This is the second temptation of the Shulamite woman. This section begins a speech that is given not by Solomon's or by the Shulamite, but by the daughters of Jerusalem. They're the ones who are talking here. And they are announcing that he's coming. It's very obvious that he's coming with his entourage. He has a parade of 60 men who are all dressed in white. They are coming and their white robes are bouncing back and forth on their horses. So it says it looks like he's coming like pillars of smoke. Tradition from Josephus said that Solomon had 60, kind of like Swiss guards guarding him. They wore pure white robes. They had bright gold shields, bright gold colored spears, and bright gold swords. So they were dressed up in white and in gold. Now what's sort of interesting is that Jesus Christ is pictured in Revelation 19. I'll just read it to you. But he returns on a white horse, and he's dressed in white, and he also has something in gold. He's got, you know, golden things to him. So we have this this interesting parallel, verse 11 of Revelation 19, I saw heaven open, behold a white horse. He who sat on him was called Faithful, True, and Righteousness. He judges and makes war. His eyes were like the flame of fire. His head were many crowns. He had a name on that no one could know. And so we have this, you know, interesting another parallel. Solomon's coming like a counterfeit, you know, return of Christ maybe, several ways to understand it. But certainly in the play, the ladies announce, who is this coming out of the wilderness, looking like pillars of smoke? He has perfume with myrrh and frankincense. He has these great smelling things he's bringing, these gifts to her. With all the merchants, fragrant powders, so all of these good perfumes that ladies would normally like to wear, he's bringing to her as sort of a gift. He says, behold, it is Solomon's couch. Now, the couch really is called a palanquin. It's a carriage that's carried by four or six or eight men, and it contains two people. It has one seat that's covered in purple and has the capacity for two people to be in it. It's supposed to be Solomon and his future queen. So we have this procession coming back. Solomon makes his procession to the ladies, being carried on this little sort of carry-along chariot. It's basically a portable enclosed chair that would fit two people. It's decorated with gold and silver on its fringe. It says here, let's continue, behold Solomon's couch with 60 valiant men around it, all the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man had his sword on his thigh because of fear in the night. They protect Solomon 24 hours a day with these golden swords. Of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin, or a carriage, to be carried on. Its pillars, or its support structure, was covered with silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple, its interior paved with love, or it's intended for Solomon and whoever he would love, or whoever would then be his king. Then it says, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and sing King Solomon with his crown, or with the crown. In other words, the crown that he wanted to then give to his new queen. So the daughters are telling each other, so they're sort of singing in a chorus, go and see King Solomon with this crown, which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. He wants to use this crown on his wedding day. So in other words, this is the temptation. This carriage is coming. Solomon's there by himself. He wants the Shulamite lady to sit up there with him and then go back to his palace and become his wife and have this crown on her head on the day of the wedding and the day of gladness of his heart. So Solomon brought her these gifts. He brought her these fragrance. He brought her these powders, the things the merchants sold, the very best. He basically said, I will give you these sweet things if you'll become my wife. Now I want you to hold here and go back to Luke chapter 4. The second temptation of Jesus Christ involved rulership over all the nations of the earth. And that's what Solomon is offering her. If you'll come with me, be my queen here, put on this crown, you can have, you know, co-rulership over all of this territory that I rule over here. She says in Luke chapter 4 and verse 5, then the devil, taking him up to a high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said to him, all this authority I will give you and their glory, for this has been delivered to me, and I will give it to whomever I wish. Therefore, if you'll worship before me, all will be yours. And he said, of course, get behind me, Satan, it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God only, and him only serve. So in her second temptation, she is offered rulership, a crown, just like in Jesus Christ's second temptation, he was offered a rulership over the earth. And perhaps in temptations that we face, we are offered something physical or something to rule over or some status. Who knows what our weaknesses are? Satan the devil finds those out from time to time. But all three of these temptations of Solomon are very important because they parallel the temptations that Jesus Christ underwent and tells us that we are going to have temptations of these type in our life. Now let's continue on to chapter 4. I think we'll have just enough time to get a little farther here. Now, what happened between chapter 3 and chapter 4, now this is kind of a conclusion based on some peripheral evidence that happens later, but it seems that the Shulamite woman gets in the carriage with him. He would have had the authority to just tell her, you must come sit with me in the carriage. Now, she did not go through with it, with the marriage in the palace. In fact, she leaves later, and they end up in the palace, so she must have gone with him in the carriage as he is taking her back to the palace. Now what happens though is apparently she gets in the carriage and goes with Solomon to his temple. She does not go to his room or to his couch as they call it. She's simply carried into the courtyard of the palace. And all along the way, her beloved is sort of following them in the background. And she has a speech that she makes about her beloved and how much she means to him. She begins in verse 1 simply saying, behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes behind your veil. Actually, this is the beloved talking to her. So as she gets into the carriage, chapter 4, verse 1 begins with the beloved or the betrothed speaking. So you hear his voice from the background as the carriage starts to move towards Solomon's palace. And he says, you are fair, my love. You are fair. You have dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. Of course, the goats don't come in a straight line. The goats kind of go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So he's saying to her that you have, you know, beautiful wavy hair, and he's giving her simply a compliment. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep which have come up from the washing. So in other words, they're very, very white. Every one of them having twins, none is barren among them. So as they are proceeding, the beloved of her is giving her a speech and telling her how much he cares for her, reminding her that she's going with Solomon in this carriage, but not to forget about him. So Solomon had the right to make her go with him. The ladies of the court are certainly anxious for that. And while they're making this little procession, we have a speech from the beloved about how important she is to him, and of course encouraging her to stay loyal to the covenant that she's made. Well, that's a good place to make a break. This second scene is quite long, and the speech that goes through here in the rest of chapter 4 and chapter 5, I think we'll break off there and start there next time.